Hi, my name's Lynette.
Hi, Lynette.
I came here tonight with a group of people from down south. Eileen, who I came here with a few weeks ago, is 86 years old and I think is our most senior member in ACA, who inspires us all the time. So we're very happy to have her with you here today. And we have Esau and Gabriella and Ray. They're all from down south as well. So first and foremost, I'd like to thank you all for having any interest in listening to me here this evening. It's very nice of you to have me come and speak. I know I enjoyed the last time that I was here. We got to hear Duncan and his travels in Russia and so on and so forth. So I've been in ACA since November of 2014. And I never thought in a million years I'd be involved in a program like this. I really paid no attention to AA or anything like that growing up, even though my dad was a blazing alcoholic from the time that he was 14 years old and drank himself to death at the ripe old age of 49. He dropped dead from drinking about, I think, 24 years ago when I was in my mid-20s. And even then, I really didn't think that I had a problem per se. I sort of just thought that was how life was. I don't actually have a family member that's not an alcoholic, a drug addict, obese, a gambler, a sex offender. I don't have anybody in my family that's not that way. So I grew up in the Midwest, in Colorado, up in the mountains for the most part, thinking that that's really just how life is. So it never occurred to me that anything about the way I grew up was abnormal. And most of the time, I just thought that there was something inherently wrong with me and that somehow I had been born with certain character defects, weaknesses. I considered myself pretty weak, even though I put myself through school and managed to live a pretty high-functioning life. I do pretty well professionally. I did well academically, but I sort of lived every single day with a hollowness to my existence because I spent every waking moment trying to convince people that I was anything but what I knew that I really was. And that gets really, really painful at some point. It gets really, really super, super lonely. And I'm sort of a master at disguise. I actually took all of the addictions, I wrote them down, not that I can't remember them, but I've been involved with, alcohol, drugs, gambling, sex. I had an eating disorder for 20 years. And I thought I had an eating disorder just because something was just wrong with me, right? I was just too weak to not have any eating disorder, and if I was a little bit stronger, maybe I wouldn't have had that. And I certainly never talked to anybody about this sort of stuff. So professionally, I'm probably interconnected with a couple of thousand people across the country. I've been nationally recognized in my field for what I do. I actually specialize in joint ventures that bring people together, and I'm always the person in the room that's responsible for resolving the conflict. For 20 years, I've been asked to be the person involved to go sit down with the most intense, challenging conflict going on and resolve it. And I just always sort of thought that that was, kind of a lucky trait that I had and something that I could contribute. And I never realized that the reason why I can do that is because of the background that I have. So in August of 2014, I had been spending a lot of time in my bedroom by myself, drinking and, marijuana and just anything to really sort of blot myself out. And I drove down Canaan, which is a major road in down south that goes into Malibu, in August of 2014, had a few drinks, and went down there to drive myself off that cliff. And I went down there and I heard my mother's voice in the back of my head saying, if it's not deep enough, you know, you could end up a paraplegic and then you'd have to come back and just suffer for the rest of your life. So either out of fear or that voice, I didn't actually drive off Canaan Dune. And I sat there for a really long time. I called my brother and told him that I was suicidal and that I wanted to drive off this cliff. And I'd probably called my brother, I don't know, 30, 40 times in my life and told him I was suicidal, so it's not as if it was anything he hadn't heard before. And I was involved in another really, really painful relationship that I had gotten involved with, a person that drinks, a person that's unavailable, a person that's four states away, you know, so on and so forth, and I was probably in more agony than I can ever describe in words. And so I started getting messages, and I don't mean to sound too spooky about the whole thing, but I started getting messages about this ACA thing. And it kept popping up for me, and it'd come up on my computer, and you know, I made one excuse after another as to why I either didn't have time to go or it was too far away, so on and so forth. And then there ended up being a meeting that I found out about that was literally three exits from my house. So I made a decision to go only because I was in so much pain that if not for the fact that I gave birth to a couple of children 15 and 12 years ago, I would not be here. Life was just too painful for me. But I'm certainly not going to saddle those two creatures with that albatross around their necks for the rest of their lives so that they have to go into therapy and talk about why their mother took her own life and why they didn't have any value and so on and so forth. So that in and of itself is what's kept me here. And I went into an ACA meeting on November 16th, 2014, and I drove into the parking lot, and some of the people in my group have heard me say before, I really thought it was just going to be me and the person that unlocked the door. And then when people started to drive up other cars, I thought, well, it's going to be a bunch of really weird, freakish people. And I'm pretty sure I'm way better than they are. And I don't need to be in this room with them. And I'm probably going to end up leaving in 15 minutes. But what the hell, I was going to kill myself this morning. So I have an hour and a half to sit in the car. So I went in. And I sat down, because I'm always early to everything, and one person after another walked into that room. And in Westlake, we have a pretty good crowd. It's a nice meeting. It's a really comfortable place. It's got a good vibe to it. Lots of great people. You know, Eileen's been in the program for 30 years. We have another gentleman, Patrick's been in the program 25 years, something to that effect. And I watched all these people come in, and I was just shocked that they were normal people, normal lives, you know, and I stayed. And then they read the laundry list, and as many people do, you hear it all the time, I sat there and went, okay, who's been looking at my life in this room, and who wrote that freaking book? And it was just amazing. And the most immediate sensation that I got in hearing that laundry list was, it's not my fault, right? It's not my fault that I'm completely filled with all of these addictive tendencies and unhealthy behavior and pain and agony and weakness and whining and complaining and so on and so forth. It made sense to me for the first time in my life, what had been happening to me. And that in and of itself was enough to bring me back into the room. So I continued for about another 6 months. I went to various groups, you know, I went to in Westlake, I went some in Agora, I went to a couple on the west side, and I worked it pretty hard for about 6 months, because that's sort of what I do. Anything that I'm involved with, I work pretty hard. And then in April of 2014, I decided that it was just too much and I'd had enough, and I quit. And I said, that's it. I'm not going back in there. These people are bugging me. I don't want to talk about this anymore. And it's just, I don't know, it wasn't making any sense to me. And so then I stopped going for about a month. And at the end of May of 2015, I tried to kill myself again. And, you know, I drank a ton of alcohol, took whatever Xanax I had for travel. You know, I'm not hooked on Xanax, but I had it in my house for travel reasons in case I have to fly across the country. And I took all that, and my boys ended up coming home and finding me there and calling my roommate. And, you know, that's just some pretty, pretty awful stuff. So I decided I probably do need to come back, and I came back. And the really nice thing was is that there wasn't one person in that room that said, you know, where the hell have you been? You're not allowed in here anymore, which is sort of what I expected. And then I stayed. I made a commitment to it. And I really can't imagine my life ever again without this program. I can't do it. So to give you a little bit of an idea, a little bit more why I am what I am, I was given up for adoption by my birth mother when I was about 18 months old, and I was given to my father and the woman that raised me, who I consider my mother, and my dad was an extraordinarily violent alcoholic, and yet he also loved me more than probably any other human being on the planet. So it was this very weird dichotomy between I love you, I worship you, and now I'm going to destroy you. And so it was a really, really heavily power-based relationship from the time I was, you know, 4 or 5 years old with a very, very powerful alcoholic man who was intensely angry because of all the abuse that he endured growing up. And so he started in with the whole sexual abuse thing when I was 6 years old. That's the first time I remember it. And, you know, he did some pretty, pretty wicked things. He would punish me without my clothes on. He would, you know, sort of just beat on me until I couldn't bear it anymore. And I've had it said to me that he didn't do that because it was sexually enticing to him. I've had it said that he did that so that he could have power, because he, as a little boy, was subjected to another human being who caused him to be powerless in that environment, and so it sort of just got passed down from generation to generation. So it was a pretty bad deal. He was very violent. His brothers were also sexually abusive and violent. And my mother, who raised me, unfortunately, who I am on speaking terms with, and, you know, this is kind of a touchy thing for us still to this day, for whatever reason, did not possess the internal fortitude to do anything about it, ever. And so it was sort of this secret thing that went on in my home from the time I was 6, you know, 5 or 6, depending on exactly when it started, till the time I was 13. And then we left. My mother finally got up the gumption, and we left and hid from my dad, who was by then the sheriff, believe it or not, in the town that I lived in. My Uncle Con, that was his name. His first name was Con. Can you imagine? And he was the deputy sheriff. And, you know, they would chase us around in the cop cars. These are the kind of things that go on in these tiny mountain towns. So whenever you hear people criticize the big city, and I do it myself, it's way safer here than it is in the mountains in Colorado, because there's nobody up there to supervise or to referee this stuff. And it's like that movie, Deliverance. I don't know however many of you remember that movie, but it's pretty wicked stuff. So we went up into the mountains, even further north in Colorado, and hid from him, literally, for months and months and months until he gave up. So, you know, that's in a nutshell basically what went on in my house. And so as a result of being involved in ACA, and because of the support that I've found in these rooms by people like yourself, which just continues to sort of blow me away, I've been able to come out, and I was never out. I was never, ever, ever, ever out. And I don't know if I'm going to mention this person by name, but I had a fellow traveler who, for whatever reason, and I honestly think it was divine intervention, reach out to me and literally, I'm not sure what the words are, push, pull, wait, demand, until I came out and told my story one night. And I remember him saying to me, come on, just tell me your story. I was like, yeah, right. And, and he said, no, I want to tell you, I want you to tell me your story. And I said, well, it's going to take at least 20 minutes. He's like, well, I'm pretty sure I have time for that. And I, you know, I came up with every excuse in the book to not share that story, because for me, that was just off the charts, painful. To talk about these kinds of things, to talk about alcoholism and sexual abuse. I was also raped in 1998 by a boss, which it's just so funny to stand up here in front of 30 people and say I was raped. And I never told anybody I was raped until I came into ACA. Nobody in my industry knows I was raped. I just left that job and carried on and got another one and did even better just to prove to him that I could. And so as a result of this program and some of the relationships that I've been fortunate enough to make, that I really, really, really think, if I'm running over, let me know, our divine intervention, there's just no possible way for it to be anything else but, because it takes that kind of power. And I didn't grow up in religion. I was forbidden from going into churches. I was forbidden from having any relationship with God, formally, that my dad was aware of, because again, that would have been a threat to his power, right? Mm-hmm. My dad basically said, I am your God. He said those very words to us on a pretty regular basis. So I didn't grow up in the church. I didn't grow up reading the Bible. In fact, every time there's a meeting and they ask me to do the prayer, I say, well, you already know I only know one of them, so we're going to have to do the Serenity Prayer again. So that's the only prayer I really know by heart. And without any spiritual foundation or religious background, I couldn't possibly believe more in a higher power because of some of the things that have taken place in my life. There is absolutely no other explanation for them, none whatsoever. And I don't have the time here tonight to tell you about all of them, but I can tell you that many of them have been quite, quite miraculous. So what I've learned in the time that I've been in this program is endless. A few weeks ago, I was sitting in a meeting, and I had started to make notes about things that ACA had influenced in my life. And so I started on this page, and I'd already had notes. By the way, I've taken notes in every single ACA meeting I've ever been in, because that's the only way I can deal with the anxiety that I feel. I walked up here with a pen in my hand, because this pen is enormous comfort to me. And so I sit in the meetings, and I've always got a notepad. I've got three notepads there, and I write everything down because it helps me with anxiety. And I started to draw this little thing with ACA, and I ran out of paper. So I went to the next page, and I know you won't be able to see it entirely, but I ended up drawing ACA in the middle, right? And I drew these little tentacles about everything that ACA had influenced in my life in the last 14 months. And I'll read them to you. My relationship with God and my faith, myself, my loneliness, my work, my ability to enjoy life, my writing, my panic, my anxiety, my ability to love, my spirit, my ability to take risks, my happiness, my ability to be vulnerable, my body, my addictions, my mind, my romantic relationships, my friendships, my depression, my fear, my counseling, my health, my confidence, and my family. There's not one thing that this program does not influence for me, for the good. And it's become a foundation in the way that I think and in the way that I approach what I do. It teaches me every day. One of my fellow travelers and I go through the book, and at first, you know, I wanted to get through the whole book in like a week. That's what I do. Okay, professionally, I can blow through 2-3 books in a week. I'm not kidding you. And he said, well, maybe we'll take it a little bit slower. And so now we sometimes, in an evening, when we spend an hour talking, we might not get past a sentence. A sentence in that book. Because it will provoke, obviously, feelings from the past. It'll provoke thought. It'll provoke observations. It'll provoke exchange. And I honestly also think that part of the major, major beauty of this program is the synergies and the synchronicities that occur amongst people. When I came to this program, I wouldn't let anybody hug me ever. Like, if you come near me, I just naturally move away. And I'm pretty sure Georgie hugged me when I walked in here, and I let you, didn't I?
You did.
I did. And that's different for me, because I didn't used to be capable of that, and now I am because of this program. There's relief in this program in knowing the things that I know now. So many things make sense to the point where I don't beat the living hell out of myself anymore if I see myself do something that's on the laundry list. Okay? I don't blame myself anymore. And that in and of itself lets out like a balloon a little bit of the anxiety that's kept me so, you know, twisted up for much of my life. One of the biggest things that I've come to discover, and this has been really recently, is this whole actor-reactor thing. And, you know, reacting to life is something that I've prided myself on, because it makes me effective at decision-making at work. You know, there's so many men that'll sit in a room and go, "You're the only woman that can make a decision quickly." And I'm like, yeah. And now I know why. It's not necessarily a great reason why, but, you know, I'm ready to go, I'm ready to react, because as a kid, I was being hit or abused or whatever it was, and I had to make decisions quickly. So professionally, that followed me into my career, and is part of the reason why I'm as successful as I am. And yet, in a personal setting, it's a bad deal. It's a really, really bad deal, because I react to everything just like this, and I try to take charge of it and fix it and run it down and kill it. And I don't want to do that anymore. And so what I've learned in the last few weeks is, like my fellow traveler says to me, no action is actually action. So I sit sometimes and I just think and I don't do anything, and I've found that my life is the quality of my life is much better with that approach than without it. The whole business about codependency and para-alcoholism, I've finally accepted the fact that I become addicted to people. I don't necessarily let alcohol take me or drugs take me. I don't let anything really take me, because I'm sort of a master at keeping it all in balance so that I can keep the facade. But I get really, really addicted to people, and then that becomes an enormous problem in my life. I've come to understand the things that are important to me as a result of being in this program. A year ago, when someone would say to me, you know, there's like a section in the book that says, well, when you were growing up, you probably didn't pursue your own dreams because you were always being told what your parents' dreams were. And I sat there going, yeah, I don't even have any. I don't have any dreams. I mean, I'm not trying to sound pathetic here. I just don't have any dreams. And so lately, in the last several months, I've started to understand who I am and what means something to me. And even though it may not mean something to someone else, it's okay that it means something to me. And so I've come to understand that things like connection and community and people and God and conversation, is what really, really makes me happy. People always make fun of me because I don't necessarily want to travel. Like at work, I get asked constantly, where do you want to go? And I go, well, who's going? Because it doesn't matter to me where we're going. What matters to me is who I'm with. And that's what's important to me. And now because of this program, I can accept that about myself. And I can live it, and I can embrace it, and I can pursue it. And that's so liberating. So I really can't imagine this program any more without this. And then the last thing I will close with is the whole topic of love. You know, they say that when you're born, God gives you a gift, and that everybody has one. And I honestly think that my gift has something to do with love. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I've just sort of been a little ball of love all my life. It's just always been a part of who I am. And yet, what I found out through this program is that I cannot walk the earth trying to find somebody to fill up that hole inside of me that exists because of what I didn't get from my parents growing up. And so now in the program, I've learned how to, I mean, some of this stuff sounds so hokey and funny, but it really means something to me now, is I'm learning how to literally stop and ask myself, well, what do I want? I told a funny story a couple weeks ago. I was in a coffee shop, and I went in there to get something for my son, and the guy that owns the place basically started badgering me into a cappuccino. I hate cappuccino. I don't drink cappuccino, and yet I almost bought a $7 cappuccino from this man. And I stood there, and I went, okay, ACA says I don't have to spend $7 on a cappuccino that I don't want to drink. And I happened to notice that he was selling green tea, so I said, you know, I'd really like a green tea. And he tried to talk me out of that, and I ended up explaining to him why I wanted it, which even in and of itself was wrong, but at least I walked out of there with a green tea instead of a cappuccino. And if I hadn't been in ACA, that would have never happened. And it might sound like something little, but coming from where I come from, where I lived basically over 40 years numb, listening to someone else tell me who I was and what I was all about and what I needed, I've had to start at my age to learn what makes me happy. And so now I'm working on becoming the person that I want to be and filling myself with love, so that when I go into my next relationship, which of course I've been advised that I'm not ready for, and I'm now starting to agree, it might be a nice thing. And I want to live my life out loud. I want to live life as myself for the time that I have left. And it was interesting, there's another fellow traveler that I have that said something to the effect of, well, this is all just such a pity, because if I had known all of this 20 or 30 years ago, my life would be so wonderful, and I'm really pissed off that I didn't learn this sooner. And I have the exact opposite thinking on that. I'm just happy that I learned it before I died, and I'm happy that I learned it at all. And I'm so happy to be on the journey that I am, and to come up here and sit in this room with all of you. It's liberating, and it's a blessing, and it's something that I'll remember my entire life, and I can't thank you enough.